Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
From New Orleans, Louisiana, ladies and gentlemen, I'm the only one here not here for the game. What game? Oh, then you'd be the other one. Yeah, it's exciting here. it's the anticipation of excitement, which is usually what New Orleans football excitement adds up to. But more about that on somebody else's show. Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I want to thank the good people at the Jewish Literary Festival in Washington, D.C. for being such lovely hosts as I flogged my new book, my new comic novel, Not Enough Indians, at their event this past week. And, you know, everybody's plugging their book now, really. I mean, Hugo Chavez held up Noam Chomsky's book, and Noam Chomsky's Amazon ranking just spiked ridiculously. So I'm seeing if I can get Hugo Chavez to hold up my book next the very next time he's at the United Nations. Not because I agree with him, but just because, you know, you got to sell books. And it's amazing to me, as controversial as his remarks were, you know, because he called Bush a devil, not the axis of evil. So that was a bad thing. If you call somebody an axis of evil, that's a good thing, right? But that Republicans in their dudgeon, in their coordinated dudgeon, have all been referring to Hugo Chavez as a, quote, two-bit dictator, unquote. It's interesting because neither half of that description is true. I mean, he was elected. He's been elected a couple times. We didn't like that he was elected. The United States government wasn't all that happy about his election or the way he ran his election. But on the other hand, there are people who, you know how that sentence ends. And as far as being two-bit, that used to be the phrase to describe Latin American leaders, despots or otherwise, until they found themselves sitting on the big pile of oil like Hugo Chavez is. I would say it would take more than two bits to get Hugo to change anything. So two-bit dictator. Check it. Check it, babe. But Washington, D.C., it's always cute to visit our nation's capital. There's a frisson of, yes, I am in the place where all this stuff happens, and yet, you know, people go to lunch and dinner every day and run along, jog like in anywhere else. But, I took a walk back from visiting an art gallery in the afternoon one day in Washington and found myself not even knowing that that's where I was going, walking along. It may not have been Embassy Row, but there sure was a row of embassies. Beautiful houses, just looked like St. Charles Avenue, New Orleans, you know, big fancy houses, except more cars in the driveway. And the one that had the most, you know, would the plural of Lexus be Lexi, in the driveway was the Embassy of the Republic of Vietnam. That's right. Just sitting there, minding its own business. Well, minding everybody's business, like all embassies are, but, you know, just another embassy sitting in Washington, D.C. And all I could think of is, I bet they're sitting inside there thinking, dang, dang, not da-nang, dang, if only we'd trained the Viet Cong to resist American interrogators the way the Al-Qaeda are training them to, we could have won that war. And then they're thinking, oh, wait a minute, we did win that war. You know, the defense for this program that the professionals are running is, well, it's a different thing. These people are trained to resist interrogation, and you just have to think, well, thank goodness the Viet Cong didn't resist interrogation, or else we would have lost that war. Ladies and gentlemen, the other thing you notice in Washington, D.C. is you think you see a lot of ads for defense contractors on the Sunday Yak shows, your Boeings and your Northrop Grummans. They're on the local news in Washington. You know, it's not the car dealers yelling at you. It's Boeing saying, be afraid, because we're there, or something like that. And it's just all over the local news. So you realize They got some bucks in that ad budget, Boeing does, Mr. Boeing. But in case you think that there are too many award shows and it's all show business's fault, this is what happens when you don't read the online version of the Washington Post and you see the actual paper that people in Washington see. There's an ad from the National Mining Association saluting the winners of three different awards in the mining business, all of them given by the federal government. Did you know about this? The Department of Labor Mine Safety and Health Administration Awards acknowledge those mines with the best safety records in the country. The Department of Interior's Office of Surface Mining Awards recognize the best surface coal mines and reclamation projects and good neighbor efforts. An award for a good neighbor effort. Well, I don't tell my neighbors. They're going to be wanting one. And the Bureau of Land Management Awards honor mines that make exemplary contributions to the lands and communities touched by minerals development. Three different sets of awards, ladies and gentlemen. And I hope the recipient mines thank all the little minds that made it possible. Hello, welcome to the show.
Sarah.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer welcoming you to this very special pregame edition. It's all pregame programming now, edition of the show. In case you don't know what I'm talking about, the New Orleans Saints are back at the Superdome for the first time since the thing. Somebody spent $100-something million to fix the Superdome. But, you know, it's a good idea, eventually. And truth to tell, most of the people I run into seem to be very enthused about it. ESPN is so enthused that they think maybe it's like the Super Bowl, except without 2 weeks' worth of hype in front. But some people here are saying, well, $100 million would have picked up the dead trees. Speaking of which, as I drive here to the campus of the University of New Orleans, I'm coming through an area fronting the lake, or near the lake. And, you know, one of the things that has always marked New Orleans scenically as a city, it doesn't have mountains and, you know, it doesn't have a seashore, but it does have this fabulous tree canopy, which you need in a hot city that was built before the age of air conditioning. And one of the sad parts of the past year, in addition to the people and the houses and the cars are gone, by the way, the maddened cars are finally gone, have been the stands of dead trees in the streets like the street that I drive, the grand boulevards with big old oak trees in the middle, as they call them, neutral ground here. They're just dead. Now we read this week in the F is for FEMA file, thousands of trees that died in New Orleans but remain standing will be removed from parkways, playgrounds, and other green spaces by FEMA, which has agreed to pay 100% of the cost after refusing only for the past year to pay for the job. New Orleans city officials, I didn't know we had any, are lauding the policy reversal as a critical step. It will result in the extraction of at least 2,000 dead trees but still standing on city property, posing a danger to nearby residents or otherwise hindering the quality of life. FEMA officials would not explain this week why they changed their policy, which called for the Army Corps of Engineers, to remove trees felled during the disaster, but to leave behind dead trees that remain standing. In other words, the old policy was to the Army Corps, take out the dead trees that fell down because of wind, which were a few, but leave standing the trees that were killed by the floods, which were your fault, Army Corps, and lasted for 6 weeks. It's in the interest of public health and safety that we fund the disposal of trees killed in the public right-of-way by flooding, says Jim Stark of FEMA. We are pleased to be working with our city partners. Man, that's press release writing. Faced with Keith Blechner, New Orleans chief city landscape architect, say New Orleans officials, they got officials in New Orleans? We're always convinced that federal money should pay for the removal of all dead trees. He said that faced with an unprecedented number of standing dead trees, FEMA relied on a narrow interpretation of criteria to rule that the trees were not eligible. Those poor trees. They must have been crushed. No, they were standing. Changing their thinking was not easy, Blechner says. City obtained letters from the Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry and the United States Forest Service reinforcing the conclusion that the trees were hazards. The project, which the Corps has already put out for bid. Really? Open for bidding? More than one bidder? Will not include the cost of stump removal. Ouch. Or the restoration of grass in the middle parts of streets called neutral grounds, parks, or golf courses, or the planting of replacement trees. 50,000 trees in New Orleans were killed by the disaster, including those that fell, were left-leaning, or lost. Left-leaning? They got left-leaning trees here, ladies and gentlemen. Alert the media. And speaking of which, it's time for a copyrighted feature of this broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. News from outside the bubble. British troops in Afghanistan are exhausted and desperately short of helicopters, and there's no sign that the casualty rate will fall. According to accounts from the officers on the front line, quoted in The Guardian and other British newspapers. The reports included a leaked email describing the Royal Air Force as, quote, utterly, utterly useless, unquote. The most graphic accounts came in emails from Major James Loden, who described British forces as desperately short of reinforcements. Major Loden was awarded the Bronze Star in 2004 by the U.S. for his services in Afghanistan in support of Operation Enduring Freedom. What happened to that? He lambasted the pilot of a British jet for firing phosphorus bombs closer to British troops on the ground than to the enemy. A female Harrier pilot couldn't identify the target, he wrote. Uh-oh. He also said two junior colleagues appeared very frightened and slow to react. We called on to help save a dying man during an intense ground battle last month. He said his men were exhausted and at times reduced to tears. The major's emails were leaked to Rupert Murdoch-owned Sky News. They came less than 24 hours after another Army officer described the scale of casualties suffered by British troops in southern Afghanistan as very significant and showing no signs of reducing. More. The American Army should scrap the warrior ethos, a martial creed that urges soldiers to demonstrate their fighting spirit by destroying the enemies of the United States at close quarter rather than winning the trust of local populations. This according to senior U.S. officers and counterinsurgency experts quoted in Rupert Murdoch's Times of London. Soldiers are instructed to live by the creed which evokes the warrior spirit of the modern U.S. Army. It begins with a stirring vow. I stand ready to deploy, engage, and destroy the enemies of the United States of America in close combat. The warrior ethos emphasis is inimical to the type of patient confidence-building counterinsurgency warfare in which America is engaged in the Middle East, according to Lieutenant General Gregory Newbold, former Director of Operations to the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon. What does he know? The future crises that relate to Iraq and Afghanistan will be a struggle for hearts and minds. Future? You mean we're not in it yet? Man, that's a relief. The warrior ethos replaced the soldier's creed, drawn up in the post-Vietnam War era, which said, I will never do anything for pleasure, profit, or personal safety which will disgrace my uniform. That's been replaced. The United States Army is phenomenal at conventional warfare, but soldiering, even in a Victorian sense, meant building roads and bridges, forging links with tribal leaders, and very occasionally killing them, says Andrew Garfield of the Foreign Policy Research Institute and a former British intelligence officer. Many British interviewees complained that the vast majority of the American military, British interviewees being military people, the vast majority of the American military personnel viewed their job as to kill the enemies of the United States. They believed peacekeeping was for wimps, prided themselves on their aggression. In their eagerness to hunt down insurgents, they would clear the homes and businesses of the innocent as well as the guilty and place bystanders at risk in firefights. In contrast, the British consider themselves first and foremost soldiers and recognize that the business of soldiering includes many essential tasks, most of which do not involve fighting. The warrior ethos was introduced in November 2003 after General Peter Schoomaker, then Army Chief of Staff, expressed alarm that soldiers in Iraq considered themselves to be support troops, cooks, mechanics, and supply staff rather than fighters. These creeds, these oaths, these vows, ladies and gentlemen, they're nutty. But wait, there's more. The fugitive Taliban commander Mullah Omar has emerged as the key player behind the Taliban's controversial peace deal with Pakistan. This according to a conservative British newspaper, The Telegraph. Remember that deal that Pakistan signed with the tribes, don't you know? The Taliban's one-eyed spiritual leader, that's the way they describe him. There's a $10 million price on his head, by the way. Signed a letter explicitly endorsing the truce announced this month. The deal between Pakistan authorities and pro-Taliban militants in the tribal provinces are designed to end 5 years of bloodshed in the area. Yeah, let's end the bloodshed. The hell? In return for an end to the U.S.-backed government campaign in Waziristan, the tribal leaders who have harbored Taliban and al-Qaeda units for more than 5 years, according to the Telegraph.
Wait a minute. They harbored terrorists? Then they're not with us.
Agreed to halt attacks on Pakistani troops, more than 500 of whom have been killed. The deal has been widely criticized as overgenerous, with no way to enforce the Taliban's promise not to enter Afghanistan to attack coalition troops. The disclosure that Mullah Omar personally backed the deal will come as a fresh embarrassment to Pakistani President Musharraf, the perv, who's in Washington meeting with President Bush, as is Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai. They're supposed to all three meet Tuesday to hash this out. That'll be fun. Officially a U.S. ally in the war on terror, according to the Telegraph, Pakistan has been repeatedly accused by Afghanistan of not doing enough to clear Taliban out of its border regions. Allegations that it denies. However, Mullah Omar clearly felt the deal benefited the Taliban, adding force to criticisms that it was, in effect, a cave-in. This can be dangerous. Tribal leaders in South Waziristan said that Mullah Omar had sent one of his most trusted and feared commanders to tell local militants to sign the truce. His most trusted and feared commanders, Mullah Dadullah. I'm sorry. Guy's name is Mullah Dadullah, and he's not a dance craze yet. He's a one-legged fighter, known for his fondness for beheading his enemies. Well, that's a good one-sentence description. A one-legged fighter known for his fondness for beheading his enemies. He is believed to be the man leading the campaign in southern Afghanistan in which British troops had been killed. Had they not been asked by Mullah Omar, none of them were willing to sign an agreement, says a tribal elder. This is no peace agreement, he continues. It is accepting Taliban rule in Pakistan's territory. Unquote. What does he know? He's just a tribal elder. Elder than what? Our friends, ladies and gentlemen, Pakistan, and the spotlight on them from another direction, too, from down under. Pardon me. From the Australian newspaper The Age, Australia has openly accused Pakistan of not doing enough to stop the Taliban, using its territory as a base for attacks on Australian troops in Afghanistan. Australian troops are moving into southern Afghanistan, the center of the Taliban offensive. So now the Australian government adds its weight to pressure on Pakistan, accusing elements in the Pakistani security forces of supporting the Taliban, as they have all along, ladies and gentlemen. Foreign Minister Alexander Downer, yes, their foreign minister is a downer, raised the issue directly with Perv in New York last week. It is unusual for friendly foreign governments to express the suspicion that Pakistani security agents allow Taliban fighters to use Pakistan territory as a sanctuary and training base. There's no doubt there are people in Pakistan who support the Taliban, Downer said. We have some concerns that in the Pakistani security forces there are some who have what you might politely describe as some sympathy for the Taliban. Unquote. Australia's foreign minister, Mr. Downer. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, copyright. Well, one more item from outside our, off our shores that you might not have heard from The Guardian. Rapper, actor, entertainment mogul, fashion executive Sean Combs, who has also been known as Puff Daddy and Puffy during his career, has lost the right to use his nickname Diddy in the United Kingdom after agreeing to an out-of-court settlement. His defeat came at the hands of a less well-known Diddy, a London-based music producer, Richard Dearlove, who has been using the name Diddy. Diddy? Yeah. Since 1992. Dearlove sued Combs for infringement after learning that the rapper had dropped the P from his name and decided to launch himself solely as Diddy. You may remember his explanation was that the P was getting between him and the fans. He was referring to an initial, ladies and gentlemen. Accepting that he does not quite have Sean Combs' global reach, Diddy Dearlove said there had been some confusion with Diddy Combs. I suffered from a head injury in 2001 when Sean Combs changed his name to P. Diddy. I lost my sight for 3 years and couldn't work, Dearlove told The Guardian. I was all ready to go last year. Then he changed his name to Diddy. I was gutted. I started getting emails from Puerto Rican girls asking if they could be in my video. And he's complaining about that. It doesn't matter how big people become, says Dear Love. This is my name. I'm not a global megastar, but what I do is valid. I'm really happy and relieved. I didn't want to go to court, but he did. Combs' personal fortune's estimated at $364 million. Wow. He will pay $15,000 in damages and more than $150,000 in legal fees. And he will have to embark on a costly rebranding of his commercial activities in the United Kingdom. But it's not his first controversy. He had another naming issue with the Japanese pop duo Puffy AmiYumi. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
There's a great big mystery, and it sure is worrying me. This diddy wah diddy, this diddy wah diddy. Will somebody tell me what diddy wah diddy mean? Well, I went to Treme, walked around. Somebody else is cruising town. Miss Diddy Wah did it. Miss Diddy Wah did it. Will somebody tell me what Diddy Wah did it mean? Little girl, about 4'4". Come on, Papa, and give me some. Your Diddy Wah did it. Somebody tell me what diddy wah diddy mean. Well, I went to church, set my hat on the seat. Lady sat down on it, said, Daddy, you sure is sweet. Miss Diddy Wah did it. Yeah, baby. Miss Diddy Wah did it. I wish somebody tell me what Diddy Wah did it mean. I said, sister, I'll soon be gone. Just give me that thing you sitting on. My Diddy Wah did it. My Diddy Wah did it. I wish somebody tell me what Diddy Wah did it mean. The church, cause the talk about Diddy was getting too much. This Diddy Wah did it. This Diddy Wah did it. Wish somebody tell me what Diddy Wah did it mean. Won't you tell me what did it mean?
Wish I could. This is Le Show. And we have some... You know, there's a story in today's, Sunday's, New York Times and Washington Post that says there's a new national intelligence estimate that says that the Iraq war is, what's the headline, worsening the terror threat. So that's all over the news. But here's the, I don't know if it's a buried lead, might be indeed, deep in the story in the New York Times, the estimates, judgments, that is to say, the judgment that the Iraq war is making the terrorist threat worse, confirm some predictions of a National Intelligence Council report completed 2 months before the invasion of Iraq. Is this the first time we're hearing about that? That report stated that the approaching war had the potential to increase support for political Islam worldwide and could increase support for some terrorist objectives. That was what our government was being told 2 months before the war, ladies and gentlemen. Cute. That's a cute. That is a definite cute. There's also this buried lead from the Los Angeles Times, deep in a story about security problems in Iraq. You've heard about those, haven't you? Army General George Casey, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, said last month Iraqi troops would not be ready for a year to 18 months. We'd heard that already. But here, deep in the story, General John Abizaid, head of the U.S. Central Command, didn't rule out new troop deployments in Iraq. He voiced doubts that any large-scale increase in U.S. troop levels would be possible. Asked whether he needed more troops, he said, quote, "Where would you like to get them from? There are 500,000 people in the American Army. It's important that the American force as a whole be managed in such a manner that it can deal with the military problem in Iraq and Afghanistan and unforeseen problems that may arise, say, from Iran," unquote, General Abizaid. Where would you get them from? Where would you like to get them from? I don't know. Peru? Yes, Peru, ladies and gentlemen. More about Pakistan. You know, don't you, that the Perv is on 60 Minutes this week saying this.
The director of intelligence told me that he said be prepared to be bombed, to be prepared to go back to the Stone Age.
Richard Armitage said that you should be prepared to be bombed back to the Stone Age.
Yes.
Were you insulted?
Yes, I thought it was a very rude remark.
He's referring to Secretary of State, Assistant Secretary of State Richard Armitage, who reportedly, according to Perv, told him through an intelligence intermediary that in 2003, in 2001, following 9/11, in, as part of the "You're either with us or against us" regime, that if Pakistan weren't with us in the war on terror, prepared to be bombed back into the Stone Age. Now, President Bush was asked about this at a joint press conference on Friday with Musharraf, and this was his response.
The first I heard of this is when I read it in the newspaper today.
Wasn't it the same President Bush who said to Brit Hume of Fox News a couple years ago that he didn't read the newspapers? And not the did we switch presidents sometime along the line and we get one that reads the papers and traded in the one that doesn't read the papers? I missed that. Perv at the joint session said news reports had mischaracterized his deal with the tribes. "The deal is not at all with the Taliban. The deal is against the Taliban. The deal is with the tribal elders," he said. We just quoted one of the tribal elders. And Bush said, quote, "I believe him." He said that Musharraf had looked him in the eye and said there won't be a Taliban and there won't be Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. Who was the last guy he looked in the eye and said he believed him? Putin. That was good. Musharraf, by the way, just to clarify, because we're in this for the democracy, aren't we? We're not for two-bit dictators who get elected. We're for Democrats who seize power, like Musharraf did in a 1999 coup, and instead of giving up his uniform in 2004 as promised, he changed the Constitution so he could hold both his general thing and his president thing until next year. And wait till you see what happens next year, ladies and gentlemen. It'd be good. It'd be real good. That's our friend, Perv, who wouldn't answer any questions at the press conference about the 60 Minutes interview and the allegation in it by him that Richard Armitage had threatened him with being bombed back into the Stone Age, by saying he has a book coming out later this month and he owes it to Simon & Schuster not to comment on the book until the publication date. At which point, the president acutely remarked,
"In other words, buy the book."
Which is always good advice, ladies and gentlemen. Hugo Chavez has it. President has it for Perv. I have it for mine. It's this book that I have that's coming out. And you can go, you can do whatever you want. But, people have pre-ordered it. People have been known to pre-order it at Amazon, let me put it that way. Or to wait and buy it at their local bookstores in October. It's called Not Enough Indians. Thank you for asking. Ladies and gentlemen, spinach. We have before us the latest in a series of crises in our food supply. And I was just speaking to Jenny here at the station where this broadcast is originating today. And she said, what are you supposed to do? I said, buy the spinach, buy spinach that's not in bags, babe. You don't eat the bags. You don't need the bags. They sell it they sell it loose in almost any store. But she said, but it's so easy. And there, ladies and gentlemen, there is the nub. We'll put up with any risk as long as it's for the sake of our ease and our convenience. So here's what I understand from reading this week about the spinach situation. Okay, so all the spinach, this organic spinach. Well, wait a minute, that's supposed to be good. Yes, but it's all grown in this big spinach factory farm situation in Salinas in Northern California, south of San Francisco. And nearby, there are big cattle farms, cattle factory farms. And because, you know, the irrigation water that they use to irrigate the spinach is always going to get some runoff from other farms. That's, you know, you put up with that. And the natural bacteria that live in normal cattle gut, I know you're eating, that sometimes will find their way into the rivers and then into the irrigation waters, they're okay. That's normal E. coli. This is different E. coli. This is a specific mutation of E. coli that lives in the guts of cattle that eat grain, that are fed grain, because now our cattle farms are feeding our cattle grain instead of grass, which is what they forage on, what they graze on. You know, they eat their cud. Well, now they're eating grain cud. It turns out that if cattle eat grain, their stomachs are higher in acid. And these particular E. coli version, this particular version of E. coli, loves a highly acidic environment. And it also loves to make humans sick. So that appears to be the nub of the problem. But in the short run, the problem is, as the New York Times deftly put it in a headline this week, bad spinach.
Money don't grow on trees. Mountain goats don't grow in crags. Rice don't grow no desert. Spinach doesn't grow in no bags. We got some bad spinach. All it's feeding is the flies. Give your kids something healthy. Cheeseburger and fries. You know the bags are packed in April. They go on the truck in May. See, fresh just meat never been frozen. All those brands are banned today. We got some bad spinach. One of the clues. You can't eat those packaged leaves. Popeye's got the blues. Now wait a minute. Bad spinach. You think it's good for you? Don't eat your spinach. Just another switcheroo. Bad bagged spinach. How'd it get this way? Feed the cow the wrong stuff. Bacteria come out to play. They play on bad, bad spinach. Man, that stuff can do you harm. Don't want your food to kill you. They better move back to the farm. Bad spinach coming to get you. You know that irrigation water. It's shouldering the blame. Maybe Coca-Cola should be that water's name. We got some bad, bad spinach. Mama, we're in a whole new zone. On that next Florentine, your eggs are all alone. See what I'm saying? I'm telling you, on your next Florentine, your eggs are all alone. Bad spinach, darling, that's what's happening. On your very next Florentine, your eggs are all alone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Le Show. And it's time now for yet another copyrighted feature of this broadcast. News of the Warm. Won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
From Canada, eh? You need a clock, eh? Vastly increased emissions of highly toxic mercury are an unexpected result of climate change in Canada's northern woods, says the U.S. Geological Service. New data suggest wildfires release 15 times more of the poisonous element mercury into the air than previously thought. That previous thinking. That's the problem. More than every U.S. coal-fired power plant combined. Those emissions could double again as the forest grows hotter and drier, says Mike Flanagan of the Canadian Forest Service, who co-authored the paper. This could be quite significant, eh? He didn't say, eh? Guess he's not a real Canadian. Climate study at UC Santa Cruz shows disappearing Arctic sea ice could ironically reduce water availability in the western United States. The sea ice covering much of the Arctic is melting, a trend that may have dramatic consequences for the western United States. Researchers at UC Santa Cruz looked at the long-term effects of reduced Arctic sea ice on the global climate. Their most striking finding was a significant reduction in rain and snowfall in the American West. The study highlights the vulnerability of Western states, which depend on winter precipitation for their water supplies, to changes in the regional climate. The results also show the surprising ways in which a small change in one component of the global climate system can affect particular regions, says Lisa Sloan of UCSC. We were surprised at the result ourselves, but it shows how interconnected the climate system is. Yeah, what a nutty thing. The climate is interconnected. Britain's leading scientists have challenged the U.S. oil company ExxonMobil to stop funding those groups that attempt to undermine the scientific consensus on climate change. In an unprecedented step, the Royal Society, Britain's premier scientific academy, wrote to the oil giant to demand. That would be frightening, wouldn't it? Something to dream about. Meeting an oil giant, a giant made entirely up, to demand that the company withdraw support for dozens of groups that have misrepresented the science of climate change by outright denial of the evidence. The scientists also strongly criticized the company's public statements on global warming, which they describe as, quote, inaccurate and misleading, unquote. The Royal Society says ExxonMobil last year distributed almost $3 million to 39 groups that the society says misrepresent the science of climate change. These include the International Policy Network, a think tank in London, and the George C. Marshall Institute, which is based in Washington. The Institute jointly published a report with a UK group that claimed global temperature rises were not related to rising carbon dioxide levels. Quote, the Royal Society says, you indicated in July that ExxonMobil would not be providing any further funding to these organizations. I would be grateful if you could let me know when ExxonMobil plans to carry out this pledge, unquote. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it's copyrighted. How about that Iraq deal? Any more about that? Yes, there is, interestingly enough. From The Independent, the London newspaper, the situation as far as torture is concerned in Iraq is now totally out of hand, says Manfred Novak, the United Nations Special Investigator on Torture. What would he know? Oh, I see. The situation, he says, is so bad, many people say it is worse than it had been in the times of Saddam Hussein. Hey, mission accomplished. Detainees' bodies show signs of beating using electric cables, wounds in different parts of their bodies, including the head and genitals, broken bones of arms and of legs and hands, and electric and cigarette burns, says the Human Rights Office of the UN Assistance Mission in a new report. The bodies of Baghdad's morgue often bear signs of severe torture, including acid-induced injuries, burns caused by chemical substances, missing skin, broken bones, missing eyes, and wounds caused by power drills or nails. Those not killed by these abuses are shot in the head. One U.S. Army major was quoted as saying that Baghdad is now a Hobbesian world. Hey, he must be reading. Where everybody is at war with everybody else and the only protection is self-protection. The U.S. Army has quadrupled the number of soldiers it trains each year to be detainee interrogators since the Iraq War began. Next year, 1,200. And the number of people training to interrogators will rise again. The Army is gearing up by hiring private companies to handle the training. $50 million contracts to private firms to handle the basic course in human intelligence interrogation. Maybe we'll outsource it to India next. The United States needs 3,000 more Iraqi forces to join the battle in Baghdad, but requests have not been met because Iraqi soldiers are reluctant to leave their home regions. That from the commander of U.S. forces in Baghdad. The United States has 15,000 troops in Baghdad. Only about 9,000 Iraqi soldiers are there. That's a fraction of the 128,000 Iraqi army troops that the United States says are trained and equipped. But they don't want to travel to Baghdad due to the distance. The distance and the killing, probably. And speaking of which, a United Nations report released this week says 5,100 people in Baghdad died violently during July and August, a number far higher than reports that have relied on figures from the city morgue. Blame the morgue. That damn morgue.
I've got a room. I've got a room with a view. I've got a room. I said I've got a room with a view. I know I got a house full of troubles, and I still got this room with a view. That's the best part. You got no pictures on my wall, just a ceiling above my head. You got no carpet on my floor, no pillow on my bed. I've got a room. I got a room with a view. Yeah. I've got a house full of trouble and a room with a view of the blue. I said they're closing in on me. Yes, they are. These old walls, you know they're closing in on me. Ain't got no food in my icebox. Says I ain't got no cable. I ain't got nothing on TV. The ceiling is getting low. It's about to touch the floor. There's a blues keep on knocking, knocking at my door. I've got a room. I've got a room with a view. I've got a house full of trouble and a room with a view of the blues. Somebody help me.
Well, help is not going to come from electronic voting machines, ladies and gentlemen. I believe it's the New York Times today, on Sunday, reports that states are now kind of swinging away from electronic voting machines, or at least trying to have a plan B, always a good idea. Here's one reason why. The access panel door on a Diebold voting machine, the door that protects the memory card that stores the votes, and the main barrier to the injection of a virus, that door can be opened with a standard key that is widely available on the internet. The same key opens office furniture, electronic equipment, jukeboxes, and hotel minibars. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, channel 136 at Sirius Satellite Radio. Available as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com.
In other words, buy the book.
Well, that's not what I'm saying, but I am. And it would be just like you buying the book, either mine or Perv's, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at internet, at interworld.net.
It was not Harry's fault.
Yeah, I guess it is. Whose fault might it be? A tip of the LeShow chapeau to the San Diego, Chicago, and Pittsburgh desks. LeShow Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the LeShow chapeau also to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO New Orleans. And the ever-present Bob Dunn, and to Pam Halstead. The show playlist available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. From New Orleans, Louisiana, ladies and gentlemen, so long.